Why does Louisiana make it illegal to arrange flowers without a license? Welcome to episode 14 of the Microeconomics Podcast with Professor James Miller. Today's episode is titled Monopoly. In last episode, we looked at perfect competition. Perfect competition is the set of economic circumstances under which firms compete to the maximum possible extent. Monopoly is the opposite. When there's a monopoly, there's only one firm in the market, and the firm has no other rivals to compete with. Now, we discussed when talking about perfect competition that profit attracts entry. If it's possible to make a profit in a market, that means you can make more in that market than any place else, because when we define profit, we take into account opportunity costs. A monopolist can earn a long-term persistent profit. But why? What would stop another firm from entering the market to eat some of its profits? So an analogy would be, imagine there's a lot of food in a yard and one of the dogs, there's a dog in that neighborhood that's slowly eating the food. Why could the dog do that? Well, it must be because something is keeping out other neighborhood dogs. There must be a fence or a barrier. For a monopolist to earn a long-term persistent profit, there has to be barriers to entry. A barrier to entry is anything that would keep another firm out. Now, in a future chapter, I'm going to also talk about oligopolistic markets. That's where there's a small number of firms. Oligopolistic markets can also have persistent long-term profits because of barriers to entry. So I'm now going to talk about barriers to entry. I'm going to do it for all types of markets, for both monopolistic markets and for oligopolistic markets. One big type of barrier to entry in the United States are legal licenses. In the United States, for a vast number of professions, you can only practice, you can only get a job in that profession if the government says it's okay. So the classic examples are for lawyers and doctors. In order to become a lawyer, you have to, you know, in the United States, you have to go to college for 4 years, then go to law school for 3 years, then take a complicated exam. And the exam is tricky enough that some pretty famous lawyers have failed, probably not because they weren't smart enough, but just the bar exam, as it's called, requires you to memorize a huge amount of useless facts. And, you know, a lot of people probably figured it wasn't worth spending too much time studying for it, and so they inadvertently failed. Lawyers, of course, love the bar exam. Now, you don't love taking it, but once you're practicing law, you want to keep other people out of the profession. Similarly, doctors as well benefit from the fact that it's very hard to become a doctor. One of the big implications of licensing for doctors is that it's tough for people from doctors from other countries to come to the United States and start immediately practicing medicine. This is why on television there's the trope of the janitor at a hospital who was a doctor in India, but he hasn't had time or been able to take the proper licensing tests yet. Also in the United States, licensing for doctors and lawyers is a state-by-state basis. So if you're practicing law or medicine in Ohio and you want to go to New York State, you can't immediately start practicing, even if you'd be doing the exact same thing. Again, it makes a lot of sense. You're a lawyer in one state, you don't want competition from other states. Now, of course, this is always presented as, oh, we need to protect the public from low-quality lawyers and low-quality doctors. And maybe to some extent it does this, but really, I think what happens with, say, flower arrangers in Louisiana gives away the game. Louisiana, at least for a while, were regulating flower arrangers, where you'd have to get a government permit to do that. And that's, you know, pretty clearly because the flower arrangers had some influence in the state legislature and they wanted to restrict the entry in the profession. Electricians too, there's, you know, in order to become an electrician, you usually have to be licensed. Now that, you know, might make sense. Well, gee, you know, an electrician who makes a mistake could burn down a house. Yeah, but if you license electricians, you'll raise their price because you'll be restricting entry, and there'll be a lot of people who don't call an electrician when they need one. So maybe if we didn't license electricians, you know, the average quality of electricians wouldn't be as high, but more people would use one, and it's entirely possible that there would be fewer deaths from electrical mistakes. Another type of barrier to entry in the United States are unions. Unions are organizations of workers that get together and try to raise their members' salaries, and they often succeed. But really, the only way to raise the salary of people in your profession is to restrict entry. Because if you know you had very high salaries, then a lot of people would want to enter. That would raise supply, which would lower price. So unions often do a good job of restricting entry into the chosen profession. Frequently, in order to get a union job, you have to get approved by the union, and the union will be very careful not to approve too many people every year, else they'll put downward pressure on wages. Another important barrier to entry is control of a vital resource. So OPEC is an oligopolistic market with oil, and OPEC, you know, not anyone can just start producing oil, because you have to have it in the ground. Or, you know, the De Beers cartel in South Africa, they have a monopoly over diamonds, and they've gotten most of the world's diamond suppliers to play along, and they're able to drastically raise the price of diamonds. By the way, diamonds are not really a rare substance on Earth. It's just this De Beers cartel has done a fantastic job of restricting the number of diamonds who are sold, and of somehow convincing consumers that man-made diamonds are not a good substitute for earth diamonds. All right. Another big source of a barrier to entry is incompatibility. Incompatibility is what protects the monopolistic position of a lot of high-tech companies. So take Microsoft Windows. Microsoft Windows is, you know, that's compatible with a lot of software. If someone wanted to make a rival operating system, they would be challenged because all of the software that's compatible with Microsoft Windows wouldn't automatically be compatible with their software. Similarly with the iPhone, you know, there's a lot of great apps for the iPhone, and if you want to make a rival smartphone, all those apps would not be easily compatible with your phone, and this would be a giant barrier to entry when you wanted to enter the market. So incompatibility comes about when you have goods that are close complements, right? If I make a good and there's a lot of close complements, someone wants to compete with me. Well, if the goods that are close complements with my product would not be close complements with a new competitor product, then it's much, much harder to enter the industry. You need to put a lot of resources into it. The next type of barrier to entry is economies of scale. Now, economies of scale means as you get bigger, your average total costs go down. So a classic case is, say, the electrical industry. It's very expensive per customer if you're just going to serve a few customers with electrical generation. It's a lot cheaper to, you know, to spend a few billion dollars on a giant electrical generating plant and to install all these wires everywhere. Then you can serve customers on average relatively cheaply. This means when there's huge economies of scale, however, that it's hard for a competitor to enter the market because you either have to enter big or you can't enter at all. Now, the telephone industry used to be characterized by huge economies of scale. To establish a landline phone system, you really need a huge fixed cost investment, and you'll have a tremendously high average total cost if you just serve a few customers. But cell phones have somewhat mitigated this, where it's possible to have a smaller cell phone system and still serve your customers on average relatively cheaply. The final barrier to entry I want to talk about is intellectual property. So this is copyrights and patents. So intellectual property is a government-granted monopoly. If you write a book, it's not the case that anyone can just go out and Xerox your book and sell them. They can only sell the book with your permission. That's a copyright law. With this podcast, you know, no one could just go out and you can't just download this podcast and sell it, although I'm giving this away for free, so on this particular podcast it's meaningless. But for, say, a higher quality podcast, someone might be selling it for $20 an episode. It would be legal for a third party to say, hey, I can sell that exact same podcast for $15 an episode because I'll just go copying it directly. For patents are like copyrights, but they're on invention. So if you invent a new drug or you invent a new engine, you have the exclusive right to sell that product. And if someone else tries to sell it, you have the right to go to court and stop them. So the idea behind patents and copyrights is that it gives you an incentive to innovate, because if you innovate, then you can earn monopoly profits on what you've come up with. Although there are also problems with copyrights and patent laws, as we'll discuss soon, monopolistic pricing will cause some deadweight loss, and this will destroy some of the wealth of society. Okay, now let's turn to how monopolies set price. Now, to do this properly, I really need a blackboard, and I don't have that, so I'm just going to give you a simple example. Let's say there's a monopolist, and the monopolist can make a good at zero marginal cost. So, you know, it can make the good completely for free once you've built a factory. Now, there's only two customers in this very simple example who want the good. Bill, and he'll pay up to $1,000 for the good. And Tom will pay $100 for the good, up to $100. Be thrilled to pay less. So again, in this very simple example, monopolists can make a good at zero marginal cost. There are only two customers in the world who would consider buying it. Bill would pay up to $1,000 for the good. And Tom would pay up to $100 for the good. You're the monopolist. What price do you charge? Well, you'd probably charge $1,000. Because if you charge $1,000, you can get Bill to pay you because he'll pay up to $1,000. Tom won't buy the good. But the only way you can get Tom to buy the good is to charge $100 or less. And if you were to charge $100 to Tom, sure, you'd sell it to Bill for $100, but then you'd only make $200 in revenue. Whereas if you sell it to just Bill, you'd make $1,000. So the monopolist in this very simple example will just sell to Bill for $1,000. But this is a waste. Remember in my example, Tom is willing to pay $100 for the good. So Tom must value the good at $100. And it costs nothing to make. So you can imagine the monopolist sells the good to Bill for $1,000. And Tom goes up to the monopolist and say, hey, you know, can we make a deal? Let me buy it for $80. I mean, it doesn't cost you anything to make. I get $100 of pleasure from it. So, you know, if you make it and sell it to me for $80, you've made $80 profit. I've made a $20 consumer surplus. We're both better off. But the monopolist would say, no, I'm not going to do that. Because if I sold it to you for, you know, less than $100, then I would have to give Bill a discount because I charge Bill $1,000. So I'd rather not sell it to you than sell it to Bill for a large discount. This is often the case with monopolistic pricing. There'd be a customer that the monopolist could profitably serve. It was just that customer. The monopolist could look at this customer and say, you know what, you'd be willing to pay more for this good than it costs me to make, or the value to you of this good is greater than the marginal cost. So if you were the only person in the world, I would benefit from selling to you. And you know, even though I don't care about this, I recognize that society would be richer if I were to make the good for you, because if I make the good, the cost to the world is the marginal cost, and if I sell it to you, the world is richer by the value you get from it. But the only way that I can sell you this good is if I give a discount to the customers who are willing to pay a lot more than you, because I'm charging them a high price and they're willing to pay a lot, and I'm unwilling to do this, so I'm sorry, I won't be selling you the good. In doing this, the monopolist creates a deadweight loss. A deadweight loss is a loss that one person suffers that no one else gets a gain from. So, for example, imagine I lose my wallet, and my wallet contains $40 and the actual wallet, and I value the actual wallet at $30. Someone finds my wallet, they take the $40, but they throw the wallet away. So the $40 is a transfer, right? I lost the cash, but someone else gained it. There wasn't a net loss on that. But the actual wallet itself, there was a loss to society of that because it was thrown away. That was a deadweight loss. I lost, no one gains. A monopolist, by setting high prices, will create transfers to itself, and it will create deadweight losses. It will create deadweight losses to the extent that it doesn't sell the product to customers who are willing to pay more than the marginal cost of making that good. If you take an intro micro class, there'll be all these fancy diagrams and more complicated examples, but they all basically come down to this Bill and Tom example where the monopolist is, again, not selling to a customer even though the customer values the good at more than the marginal cost. And the monopolist isn't doing this because to sell that good to that customer, the monopolist would have to give a discount or lower its price to the customer who's willing to pay a lot. Now let's talk about ways of reducing the deadweight loss for monopolists. Well, the big one is competition. Competition can destroy monopolies, even if the competition isn't perfect. So the post office in the United States, you know, had a monopoly guaranteed by law, sort of written into the Constitution even. But, you know, email, fax machines, telephones all eroded the monopoly and made any of the deadweight loss caused by the post office less important. Microsoft Windows was a monopoly, but it was eroded eventually by competition from Linux, the free open source operating system, and of course, Apple's operating system. Cable television was a monopoly, and that cable television came about because of economies of scale, but that's of course been eroded to some extent by the internet, but also by satellite television and DVD players. Even when there isn't actual competition, potential competition can reduce the harm of a monopoly. So going back to my dog example, the dog, let's say, is eating food slowly because he knows the fence is protecting its food. But maybe, you know, the dog's like, geez, maybe this dog could jump over the fence, so I better eat the food quickly just in case the dog jumps over the fence. An analogy would be a monopolist that's charging really high prices, but saying, us charging really high prices is a powerful signal to companies in other fields that they should try to break through our fence, enter our market. So let's not charge quite as high prices just so we discourage potential competitors, because we don't want to be too profitable. We don't want to create too much deadweight loss, so that's just a signal that other smart players will enter. Another way of reducing the deadweight loss of a monopolist is through price discrimination. Going back to my Bill and Tom example, remember Bill is willing to pay $1,000 and Tom is willing to pay $100, and it costs the monopolist nothing to make. What the monopolist would love to do is just go to Bill and say, Bill, price for you is $1,000. Tom, price for you is $100. If the monopolist can do this, there'll be no deadweight loss. You know, you could have a more complicated example of a lot more people, and for every person, the monopolist would love to go to each person and say, all right, what's the most you're willing to pay? We'll sell it to you for this amount, so long as you're willing to pay more than the marginal cost of making the good. If the monopolist can perfectly price discriminate, all the deadweight loss goes away. The monopolist profits very high, but still there's no deadweight loss. Of course, you can imagine something wrong with the following pricing scheme. You know, someone comes to your store, you say, what is the most you would pay for my product? They tell you, you then charge them this amount. It's just possible that customers would catch on and would lie. So we've got a huge problem of price discrimination in that companies will not be able to easily ascertain how much customers are willing to pay. So this is why a lot of companies use complicated methods to try to figure out how much customers are willing to pay. So airlines are good at this. It costs a lot more to fly if you're going to stay over, not going to stay over a weekend than if you are. So if you're going to leave on a Monday and come back on a Thursday, your airline ticket will probably be a lot more expensive than if you're going to leave on a Friday and come back on a Monday. Excuse me. You might think, why do airlines care? Well, airlines figure that business travelers will be willing to pay a lot more for tickets and people traveling on vacation. And excuse me. And as a result, they try to look at what kind of traveler you are, and they'll charge you more if they think you're traveling on vacation. Other examples of price discrimination. Al Gore actually, when he was running for president, came up with this example, and it turned out not to be true, but it's such a great example, I'm going to say it anyway. Al Gore said that his mom and his dog were both taking the same medication, and his dog actually paid less. So, you know, he got the same medication at his doctor and his vet, and the vet charged less. Wasn't true, but it would make a lot of sense. Imagine you're a pharmaceutical company. You spend a lot of money developing a drug for a heart treatment or something, for heart disease. And, you know, you sell it to people. Your plan was to make most of your profits selling it to people. But it turns out, you know, dogs have hearts, and the medicine can also help dogs. But there's no way you'll be able to charge anywhere as much, you know, for dogs as you do for people. Maybe it cost you a penny a pill to cover your fixed costs and to make a bit of a profit. Maybe you're charging $1 a pill for humans, but you know, you gotta take it every day. Most pet owners aren't gonna aren't going to spend a dollar to reduce the chance, a dollar a day to reduce the chance of their dog having a heart attack, while most people definitely would for their mom. So you say, okay, for dog owners, we'll charge them 10 cents a day. Now, the problem this could cause is that some people who need the drug could say, well, I'm going to go and get the drug for my dog and then use it for myself. So this is another problem when you price discriminate, and that people who are given the right to buy it at a low price might go and resell the good. So you got, if you price discriminate, you have to somehow prevent resale, or else you'll just end up selling it to all the people who don't value it very much, who you found don't value it very much, and then they'll end up just reselling it to people who value it a lot. Now, the organizations that are the masters at preventing resale are colleges. A lot of colleges, including mine, will give very generous financial aid packages to some students, not to all, but to some. Now, what you're certainly not allowed to do is, you're not allowed to say, hey, I got into Smith College, I'm getting $30,000 financial aid a year. You didn't get into Smith, so why don't I just give you my financial aid package? So I'll sell it to you. You wanted to go, and I'll give you my financial aid package, and you can go in my place. No. That's not allowed. Colleges will give special financial aid packages for each person. Colleges also, of course, get a lot of information about you. They know your grades, but they also ask you to submit your parents' tax returns. Colleges figure, the richer your parents are, probably the more you're willing to pay. So colleges are very good at getting information to figure out the most you're willing to pay and stopping you from reselling. Movies, movie ticket prices are very different depending on whether you see the movie. If you see it on a weekend, you've got to pay more than if you see it, say, 3 o'clock on a Thursday. Well, probably, people who have jobs and, who have families, they really can only see movies on the weekends, and they're willing to pay more. Whereas if you can see a movie at 3 o'clock on a Thursday, you're probably going to be willing to shop around to go to get the best price, so they'll charge you lower prices. Books often price discriminate through impatience. Books often first come out in paperback, then they come out in hardcover. They come out first in hardcover, then they come out in paperback. And the hardcover books are much more expensive, and that can't be just because of the cost of materials. What the publishers figure is, some people really, really want to read this book, and they'll pay the most. So we'll first sell the book, and we'll charge a lot of money. Then after a year or so, we'll greatly lower the price. And of course, everyone realizes this, but there are people who want to read the book enough that they're willing to pay a lot to get it right away. My favorite example of price discrimination is coupons. So coupons are great. Think of what coupons are. In return for clipping something out of a piece of paper, for your newspaper, you get a discount. Now, you're not doing anything of any social value for clipping something out of a newspaper and presenting it to the cashier and slowing down everyone in the checkout line. So why are stores giving you a discount? Well, imagine, there's two supermarket chains in your town, say Big Y and Stop and Shop. And they figure that each have two kinds of customers. The first customer does not price check. The first customer will just go to a store and buy whatever and check out, and then they won't even bother looking at prices. You'd like to charge those customers very high prices. The second customer will go to each store and find which store is charging the least. So, when you do your daily shopping, you kind of know which store charges the least. You go to both stores and you get your items at the lowest price. So for those customers, the stores would charge lower prices. So how is it that you charge lower prices for your price-sensitive customers? Well, you say, if you really are price-sensitive, prove it to me. We're going to put a piece of paper we're going to put a coupon in a newspaper, go to the trouble of cutting it out, and then taking it to the store, and that'll prove to us that you're price sensitive, and we'll give you a discount. By the way, another nasty tactic, and I don't know if Big Y or Stop and Shop do this, but sometimes what stores will do is, let's say they're selling, seven types of cashews. They might just randomly charge a lot for one of the types of cashews, not for any reason of cost. Maybe all the cashews are selling for around $7, but for one, they'll charge $12. And they'll figure, if you're a price sensitive customer, this isn't going to bother you. You'll see, most of the cashews are priced at reasonable price, and you'll buy one of those. But if you're not a price sensitive customer, you just go and grab some cashews. Occasionally, you'll get unlucky and you'll grab the really expensive ones and ha, we can make a higher profit off of you. Sometimes if you go to restaurants, you'll notice not all the prices are on the menus. Well, I've talked about this with my students, so I know this is true for students where restaurants where my students have been waitresses. Sometimes restaurants don't actually have a price in mind. When the waitress goes and figures out the bill, she'll make up the price, and she'll do that based upon how much she thinks you're going to pay. You know, if you look, you know, you're kind of look kind of wealthy, and you look like you wouldn't complain if the menu prices are too high, you'll end up paying more than someone who's price sensitive. So if I want to get something on a menu and the price isn't listed, my personal philosophy is I always ask when I'm ordering, how much does this cost? Part of the reason I'm doing that is to signal to the waitress, I'm a price sensitive customer. So I'm one of those customers who, you know, are cheap. And if you give me too high a number, I won't pay that. Or I might not come back to the restaurant if I'm upset because I think the prices are too high. So, okay. That's it for price discrimination. Let me conclude by talking about monopolies and incentives to innovate. Monopolies often have strong incentive to innovate because they get to capture all their gains. So let's imagine innovation in the refrigerator market. If you can come up with a better way of making a refrigerator, and you're the only refrigerator maker, you can capture all of those gains. So you've got a lot of incentive to do that. In contrast, if there's a large competition to produce refrigerators and you come up with a better refrigerator, your rivals will quickly watch what you're doing and will copy it. So you'll have gone to the expense of figuring out what works, but then other people will get the benefit. Now, to some extent, you'll try to use patent law to protect yourself, but you know that's always difficult because it's, you know, your rivals will try to figure out a way of doing the same thing that you did but without violating your patent. So monopolies can capture more of the gains from innovation, so they have more of an incentive to do it. But there's a downside in that firms are not always perfectly profit maximizers. And if you're a monopolist, you can afford to be a lot lazier. A lot of employees are motivated not so much to maximize their paycheck, but to make sure they don't get fired. And if you're a monopoly earning good profits, you can figure, you know, even if we're pretty lazy, we're not going to all be fired. Well, if you're in perfect competition and you're lazy, you know, you can all quickly lose your jobs. So if you've got a firm that's really devoted to profit maximization and it's a monopolist, then it has a huge incentive to innovate. If there's a firm where they're mostly motivated by survival, they're like, let's work just hard enough so that we don't get destroyed, then having a monopoly will make them lazier. Let me conclude by looking at vitamin D. Now, let me say, I'm not a medical doctor, so this might all be crap, but from what I've read, you know, a lot of Americans are deficient in vitamin D. And vitamin D is fairly cheap. So why don't we see these advertisements promoting vitamin D? I mean, we see all these ridiculous advertisements promoting the health benefits of these sugary cereals, where they're, you know, almost certainly bad for your health. Why isn't someone making vitamin D and saying, look, you know, here's these 1,000 clinical studies saying taking vitamin D is healthy and it's cheap? That's because vitamin D is effectively produced in perfect competition. No one has a monopoly on it. Anyone can make it really cheaply. So if one company were to start running commercials saying, you know, take vitamin D, it's extremely healthy, and they were to succeed in greatly raising the demand for vitamin D, that company wouldn't earn any of the profits because, you know, to the extent the price went above marginal cost, other companies would start quickly making vitamin D. So maybe to take a radical approach, maybe if we think there is a problem of people not taking enough vitamin D, government should auction off a monopoly to vitamin D, give it to some company that's not lazy, that's, you know, driven by profits, and it would have an incentive to advertise and sell vitamin D. Now, of course, it would charge a lot higher price, so this would annoy someone like me who does take vitamin D and gets to take it cheaply, but it would be tremendously beneficial to all the people who need vitamin D but don't take it because they don't know about it. Although, again, keep in mind, I'm not a doctor. Perhaps vitamin D is harmful. What do I know? All right. Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Microeconomics Podcast with Professor James Miller. Bye-bye.